Welcome back. I'm Gary Parr.
And I'm Christine Williams.
And you're listening to Fiber Talk, the weekly podcast for people who play with needles.
Yes, indeed.
It's what we do. It's what we do, yes. And our guest this week from Colorado, Tony Gerdes. Tony, welcome.
Well, thank you.
Really glad to have you. Now, okay, we got this long bio, and I'm not going to read it all, but Tony, all forms of needle art, including needlepoint, embroidery, cross-stitch, knitting, crocheting, weaving, and just playing with threads. She just sits in a corner sometimes and just plays with threads.
Yeah, sometimes I do.
Biggest influencer designs is the element of color. She's a level 2 teacher from the National Academy of Needle Arts, specializing in canvas embroidery. Serves on the National Academy of Needle Arts as Director of Education and Board of Directors for the Mile High American Needlepoint Guild Chapter as President and President of NETA.
NETA.
NETA. What is NETA?
NETA is the National Embroidery Teachers Association.
Oh, my.
And basically, we just help, you know, the teachers join this so that they all can get on the group Yahoo discussion.
Okay.
So we know what's going on, you know, like we get information about who wants proposals and things like that.
Okay. Had not heard of that one. So let's see. So you've taught for National Academy of Needle Arts, Embroidery Guild of America, American Needlepoint Guild, published in Needlepointers, Needlepoint Now, Needle Arts, as the Artist Across America, and then you're teaching in May at the Embroiderers Guild of America at the Great Lakes Region Seminar in May. So you're busy.
Yes, I am busy. I'm gone a lot, but it's fun.
Yes. And you live in the mountains of Colorado and you leave it all the time. I don't understand that thinking.
But I come back all the time.
Okay.
There's nothing like driving over that last curve, and then you see Mount Princeton, which is the mountain that's the closest to us.
Okay.
And, you know, you see those peaks, and you know you're almost home, and it's great. Mm.
Yeah. Yeah, I have to say I'm jealous. I'm jealous, yep. Okay, so let's get the where you started thing out of the way, because I got questions about some of your designs I want to get to.
And, okay.
So tell us, you know, give us the background. Where'd you get started? How'd you get interested in this?
Early stitching, gosh, that goes back to my mother was sort of like us. I mean, she wanted to try it all. And so she really loved crewel the best, but she did a little bit of everything. And I remember buying this kit when I was, I don't know, maybe 10, and it was Quick Point. And it wasn't small, let's just say. It was a Christmas tree skirt. You know, jump right in.
Yes. We don't know anyone like that.
No.
So it took me several years, and I think she ended up finishing it for me. But that was my first needlepoint project. And then I just tried a little bit of everything and eventually joined a guild in Kansas City. And, you know, I remember one of the program chairs said, she was talking to the whole group. She goes, I need someone to take this next design and stitch it and teach it. And so I put my hand up. I had no idea.
Oh, no,
what I
you
was
didn't.
Well, she got so excited about things that everybody else got excited too. And so afterwards I went over to this lady that I had been my teacher, and I said, so what does this mean that I need to do this? And she said, oh, Tony, it's easy. You just, first you stitch it, and then you tell everybody what you did. And I thought, well, I can do that. And that was my first teaching experience. So several years later, I decided to go to the National Academy of Needle Arts and go through their teacher certification program because it seemed like a good idea.
Yeah,
to get
probably
a little background. And I'd been teaching for shops and my chapter at that point. But they have a 3-year program. It's a great program. And when I got done, I started proposing, and I've been teaching ever since. So it's been good.
Well, you just dive in with both feet and
I did.
Help me out here. National Academy of Needle Arts. Now, I mean, I'm a member of the American Needlepoint Guild. That's, you know, that's a given. I know that one.
Yeah.
What,
yeah.
National Academy of Needle Arts, how is that different? Because that's, there's a lot of needlepoint in that too. How is that just, well, other stuff involved, or how does that work?
It's a small or smaller organization than the American Needlepoint Guild. It's, you know, I'm not sure of our total membership right off the top of my head, but it's a much smaller organization, and its primary purpose is education. Specifically, we have teacher certification programs, judging certification programs. We have a program to train people to run exhibits. And so once a year, we have a seminar, and it's a very, you know, it's much smaller than A&G, but we have a beautiful exhibit that people enter. It's a judged exhibit. And then we have a seminar just where people can come and take classes, just like you're used to at A&G. But before that starts, the 3 days before that starts, we're teaching people that want to become teachers and judges.
Oh, okay.
And that's where it's a little different. So that's an intensive program. The programs are 3 years for teacher certification. It's a 3-year program, but you have to come to the National Academy of Needle Arts assembly or seminar 4 years and go through the, you know, on-site training along with all the at-home work that you do.
That is intense.
Yeah.
Wow.
But it's just, it's a wonderful program.
So when you're done with that, you're equipped.
Right.
Yeah.
And we meet once a year in Troy, Michigan, which is a suburb of Detroit. And it's actually a wonderful spot. And Troy is a wonderful little town, and that's where we meet every March.
Yeah, see, I'm originally from Michigan. Grew up north of Flint, and that's Flint before they had lead in the water. But
yeah.
So I know the area. How is it that Troy becomes the place?
Well, it started out originally. It was at the Valentine Museum, I believe. This goes back before my time a little bit. So we're in the process of writing a history. And then we were at the Homestead back east and the Greenbrier, and eventually moved to Kansas City, which is where I came in, found out about it, and started going. It was in Kansas City for 10 years. And then we decided to move it to Colorado, which worked fine with me because it was about the same time I was moving to Colorado. We were in Colorado Springs for 2 years, and then we moved to Troy because a couple of people on the board live in that area, and found this small family-run hotel called the Somerset Inn that is just an ideal place to have a small seminar. It's, you know, I think it's 12 stories maybe, and family run with a in-house restaurant, and they just have great meeting rooms. And so we found that it's just a good home for us, and that's where we are.
Oh, okay. All right. Wondered about that because my friend Missy Taphorn went there last year, and she really enjoyed herself. And I have family still in Michigan and in that area, and so I'm tempted. And
well, you'd be welcome.
I think you should do that, actually.
I think so. Wow. This year I had to be out of town for something else. But, yeah, I think I need to plan for that because it sure sounds like a fun, smaller, more approachable event. So.
Well, I have to say I like all the events. I mean, I would love to go to every single one every single year if I get a job, I'm there. Because I think they're all great. They all have a little bit different personality, but I love them all.
Yeah. So, okay, so you become a teacher, and obviously you enjoy doing that. So ever since you started teaching, you've just been teaching all these years, however long it's been?
Yeah, I started, I think my first national seminar was in 2010 in Columbus, Ohio at A&G, and I've been teaching every year since. And so when I'm not at a national seminar, I'm teaching for regional EGAs, local, you know, different chapters all over the country of ANG and EGA. And then Nan, and a couple we didn't mention that I used to love teaching at Callaway. It's gone now. But Blue Bonnet Studio, and there's a new little seminar happening in New England starting, I think it's next year, in 2018, Needlepoint in New England. So, you know, they're all fun.
Needlepoint in New England. Where do you know where that's going to be?
Yes, if I can just think of it.
Because I'll just about kill to get to New England if it's an opportunity.
Okay. I'm going to tell you, but I might make noise for a minute reaching over here to my...
That's okay. We'll chat amongst ourselves.
Okay.
Yeah. So actually, while you're doing that, so I've been looking up, you know, we've talked a lot about guilds, which is new to me for this hobby. So I've been looking into guilds and things of around where I am, and I'm finding it really difficult because, so for example, I just looked up the EGA here on Long Island. And our meetings, so there's one chapter on all of Long Island, and it meets on the first Wednesday of each month at 10 o'clock in the morning.
Oh, that's hard for someone that works.
Yeah, it's hard for people who have jobs. So that becomes completely a non-starter.
Yeah, that's too bad.
Yeah, it is. Hmm. And I remembered, I think we looked at this for another one, and it was a similar, wasn't quite that bad, but it was a similar thing. So I would think that in New York and Long Island, it would be really easy. And I'm finding it really difficult to find other people that are doing this, at least on an organized level to this point, you know, that's not just a shop that has a, you know, Saturday afternoon, everybody bring your knitting kind of thing, you know, because I'm sure I could go into Brooklyn and find, you know, lots of hipster people doing that. But what I'm looking for is more of the types of things that you guys are talking about, where it's a more organized thing and there's classes and structure, and it doesn't seem to be the case here.
Yeah, go ahead.
Have either of you gotten on Facebook on the Needlepoint Nation group?
Yes.
Yes.
Regularly.
Well, that might be a place to say, you know, hey, is anyone near here that...
Yeah, I might try that. Because, Gary, I know you belong to a guild, and you get quite a bit out of it.
Oh, yeah. No, I belong to the Fox Guild here in northwest of Chicago. Yeah, it's a terrific guild, just a bunch of great people, and... The people who put together the programs, every month we have a tremendous program. No, the organizations I've been a member of through the years, different hobbies and different things, this is by far the best. Really just, I look forward to the meetings and what goes on and the people. Yeah, no, exactly. I know what you mean. It's a real plus.
Fox Chapter sounds like a great group. I'm actually a member of your group because... Last year at seminar, I joined because they wanted me to come to their breakfast, and, you know, then I had to join. So.
Yeah, Mary McGuire and company put together apparently quite a – I've never been, but apparently quite a breakfast. It's
yes.
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 So, okay, so where is it? You were looking up. Did you find it?
Yes, it's in Connecticut. I'm not sure which city because I would have to Google that because it isn't in my file, but it's in Connecticut. In April of 2018.
Okay.
So you can find it. If you Google Needlepoint in New England, you'll find the information.
All right. I'll look it up and put it with the notes for this show. So Christine, just up the road for you.
Yeah, that would be doable. Yeah, possibly. Yeah, for sure.
Yep. Okay, there we have one. Yeah, I love New England. I don't care. I don't care where it is or what it is. I love it.
Well, I know in I have to go to Denver to go to chapter meetings. And like I said, that's about a 2.5 hour drive for me. But we have two ANG groups. One's a night group and one's a day group. And then we have two EGA groups. So it's, you know, maybe there's something out there you just haven't found yet, Christine.
Right. And it may be the city. You know, I may have to go into Manhattan to do it.
Yeah.
Which would be... you know, for me, again, that's quite a trek. I'm just surprised that on all of Long Island there isn't, you know, a group that doesn't meet during business hours.
Right.
It's just surprising to me. But, well, we'll figure it out. Perhaps I just haven't looked long enough yet. I will keep you posted.
Okay, we'll look forward to that report.
So if anyone is listening and knows, please let me know.
Tell Christine where to go.
Yes, because I am, you know, in this regard, in this particular sport, if you will, very much a beginner, or, you know, I haven't done this level of needlework ever, and none of this since I was a child, really. So I'm looking forward to actually being able to do, you know, adult level work. and it'd be nice to do it with other adults. So, you know.
Yeah.
Yes.
And speaking of that, we didn't talk about what we're working on. So, Christine, how's that hat coming?
Yeah, hat's going. So have I told you about the Cats with Hats book?
Yes.
So that's the next thing, is I just procured yarn to start knitting hats for my son's cat, because his friends think it's hilarious, because they're all middle school kids, to put hats on their cats and take pictures and put them on Instagram. So, I found a book that is called, I think it's called Hats for Cats, or Cats and Hats, or something along those lines. And it is the most ridiculous and adorable knitted, little hats. Just the right size for a cat, or perhaps a small dog, that, you know, you could do up in an afternoon or something. So I'm going to start doing one of those probably in the next day or so. Well,
that's fun. Well, you sent me a picture a while ago of Cats and Hats, and I got to admit, it was pretty hilarious.
It's hilarious. It really is. You know, you can knit a little hat that makes your cat look like it's wearing a pumpkin head. I mean, how can that not be funny, right?
I have a lot of knitter friends here in Buena Vista. I'm going to have to look this book up and pass it on.
Really? And, you know, there's like hats that are, you know, like a Santa hat or an elf hat, or, you know, things like that. But then there's like a hat that makes it look like your cat has a mohawk. I mean, they're just really funny little things. So, yeah, I couldn't resist. So that will be the next thing, because I kind of need something a little silly to work on for a while.
Yeah. All right.
Gary?
Lady Edith has captivated me. I am...
Yeah.
Tony.
No, I just think that's such a beautiful piece.
Oh, it is. I thought that was a good one or a bad one.
I thought that was a bad one. I thought,
no. No, that's a good one. It's a beautiful piece.
Yeah, I have to say, it absolutely has me captivated. I'm about 2/3 done, and I can see the end, and I'm screaming to the end now. It's every moment I get, I'm stitching something. And Marga, my wife, has... she's monitoring me. She wants that thing done. And she already has plans for how she wants to frame it as an easel type piece. And she says,
nice.
She says, that one's mine when it's done. And it's like, whoa, aww. Okay.
All right.
Yeah. Now go ahead.
What are you enjoying stitching about that one in particular?
It's a different challenge. It's all silk.
Mm-hmm.
Use all silk threads and different threads. And she does some interesting things. It's with just single strands. I don't know the stitch names, but she does some interesting things just around the edges. And it's creams and browns and red. And then she outlines things in a real dark Krynek. And it's just an interesting mix. And she really, it's Gay Ann Rogers. She is the Gay Ann Rogers. And, It's not like anything I've done before. And, I mean, it's a four-sided piece and all four sides are the same. But, I'm really enjoying it. And the challenge I'm finding is I'm really particular about making sure that, I have open holes between rows of stitches, and I don't, you know, stuff isn't showing through the back. And she makes the back a real challenge. And I'm finding a warped sense of fun out of that. In that, you know, where I start and where I end. And, so that's been like a flip side challenge that I really enjoyed is starting and ending the threads so that they, cause there's plenty of open space. So, it's been fun. It's been fun. It makes me want to get a couple more of her designs to, I actually have one, and when she I hope it's in part of her sale the next time she does it. But I really enjoying this, and I did not expect it. I got it. It's so weird. Margaret got me hooked on Downton Abbey. I resisted the first couple three episodes, and next thing I knew, I was just locked into that thing. And
yes, I understand.
Yeah, and Lady Edith is the character that I mean. I just really developed feelings for her in terms of what she went through as a person. You know, kind of the outcast and and the misfit and those things. And then when I saw Gay Anne had these designs for the mother and the two sisters, and you know that one I just related to, I liked it, and the colors are just beautiful, and you know, I'm stitching as prescribed. So just one of those.
I'm about to make you very jealous. Last summer, that was my summer trip. Was I went to Highclere Castle, which is where they filmed that, and. They, in order to film the show, I think they move one piece of furniture approximately in the library. The desk is not where the desk is normally kept because there's a family, the family that lives there. The Lord, the Eighth Lord of Carnarvon, actually lives there, with his family, and they film it, and pretty much the house looks exactly the way you see it. There is very little. Like, you walk through, and the only difference is, like, they'll have pictures of their family there, which, you know, they take the, you know, modern pictures out when they're filming.
Yeah.
But, you know, the library is where they sit and do things. You know, the place where you – all of those places are in – I mean, they are exactly the way you see them. And from a needlework perspective, all of the embroidered things that you see there are all there exactly the way you see them.
Wonderful.
It is stunning. It is absolutely stunning. Wow. And the pictures – so, and Gary, I don't think you knew this. The pictures that I took that were used to make the inspiration for – one of my tattoos were all from Highclere.
Oh, really?
So, So I had taken pictures of photos there that were all very sort of quintessential English flowers. And
that's where you got those from.
Yeah, they were all at Highclere. So, you know, you can walk the gardens there. And it is, I mean, it's stunning. And there are more gardens there than you see on the show, and they're absolutely beautiful. And so that was all done. All those photographs were taken there.
Hmm.
So, yeah, if you have the opportunity, so a little bit of a – we're doing a little bit of a side note here. Look up Highclere Castle, and you can see a little bit about the castle itself and the grounds and the family that's lived there. It is absolutely fascinating. So definitely worth it. To check that all out, because it is way more interesting than the show is, even, I would say. And if you enjoy the show, you'll enjoy learning about the building and the grounds and the history even more. So there you go.
All right.
Wow. Sounds wonderful.
It was magical. It was absolutely magical. There's no way other way to put it. I would go there again in a heartbeat.
Oh, I'll have to check this out now. Yeah, I got locked into that Downton Abbey. It's a
beautiful place.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Learn something there. All right.
There you go. Okay. So, Tony, what are you working on?
I am working on I'm going to be doing the Stitch of the Month for ANG in 2018. So I'm working on that at the present time, along with several other things. But I'm trying to get that finished up by the end of the week.
Yeah, no pressure on you for that. Huh? That's a big deal to get selected for that, right?
Well, I'm excited.
Yeah.
I
would be.
Yeah.
It's going to be, I think it'll be fun. I think people will enjoy it. It's on darning patterns, so we'll see.
Oh, you got me, because I don't get those. So.
Well.
All right, I'm with you now. Okay.
Okay. And then I'm working on, you know, for when I go to Anaheim to teach at ANG this summer, I have to have my pieces to teach for Washington, D.C. in 18 so they can be on display. So I'm working on those, too.
Oh, you're busy. Wow.
Yeah.
So so you got – that's right. You got to show up a year ahead of time all finished. Yeah.
Right. Right.
Yeah. Yeah, that seminar fascinates me in that so much happens so far ahead of time.
Right. We have to really work a couple years out.
Yeah. I got to get to one of those, I guess.
Yes.
I guess I just got to.
This may be a sort of silly neophyte question, but do you find that working that far in advance handicaps you in the sense that you can't incorporate trends that are going on, or does needlework not move that quickly that would be an issue?
Well, I don't think it's come up. I've never felt pressured that way. I mean, usually I'm so intent on what I'm designing that I'm not worried about like the next trend. Now, mm-hmm. when I see something brand new, I want to use it, but it'll be in a piece down the way.
Okay.
Because I do like to use every new thread that comes out if I possibly can, you know.
Right, right, right. Because with some things, and then once you, you know, if you don't get on it, you know, right away, then you miss out on something. And I wondered if that was, you know, a problem or if that was enough. Something to take into consideration, or if it was just something that, okay, now I know I can use this and it'll be available and I'll use it when I get around to it.
Yeah, it seems like it's worked out okay. I mean,
yeah.
A few years ago, I came across this stuff called Wonder Ribbon, and it sort of looks like flair, but it's made out of wire, and you can stretch it out and make it real sheer and then do different things with it on your canvas. And I incorporated in a couple of my pieces already, and I still find that when I teach it, people haven't seen it before. I mean, there might be some people in class that have, but there's always people that go, oh, I've never heard of this. So it seems like you have enough time to use it before most people have seen it.
Before it becomes passé.
Yeah.
Is that usually your reaction, Tony, when there's a new thread or new set of colors, is you want it because you want to see what you can do with it as a designer?
Yes. Okay. Yes. Definitely. When I'm at, you know, if I'm at a store, I want to see whatever's new that came in. And I just buy threads, you know, we all have our stashes, but I buy them, whatever's new, I want to have some of it in case I can think of a way of using it.
Okay. I mean, I can see that, and you know, I keep it's intrigues me because there was a somebody Colors, Colours, I think up in Canada, is having a sale right now on different pearls and silk pearls, and I had the site open today, and I almost bought a bunch of stuff, and then common sense says for what, and then I said, well, you know, it was back and forth for what, well, just to have it. And then,
yes,
but I don't have a use for it right now. And, you know, the conversation in your head, well, and then I didn't pull the trigger and I probably should have. Yeah. Just to have them. just to play with threads.
You have to become a designer and a teacher, and then you know that you have to design things so you'll use it.
Oh, that opens the door. If you're a designer, then that gives you the justification. Oh, I got to do that.
Right. Now you've got permission.
Right.
Okay. all right. I can do that. I couldn't design a thing, but, you know, I could at least work with a justification. That's fine.
I was going to say, it doesn't matter. You just can tell yourself that.
Okay. I'm officially a designer as of this moment. I'm buying thread
there
after
you go.
We're done. Yeah. Okay.
We will gladly be your enablers.
Thanks
yes.
so much for that.
You're welcome.
Okay. So, Tony, so you raised your hand at this meeting and said you'd teach. How does the designing part come in? Did that just evolve in, or did you just someday have an inspiration and say, I think I'm going to do this?
It sort of evolved. I mean, the first piece was someone else's, you know, it was a charted piece that belonged to someone else. I stitched it, I taught it, and I didn't change anything. Over time, you know, you start to change a few things, like that you think might make something better. And then eventually you say, well, maybe I could, you know, you have an idea and you think, well, maybe I could do this, and you try and someone likes it and you keep going after that. And what really made me, I mean, I had done a few things of my own, a few designs of my own, but when you go through the National Academy of Needle Arts, you're expected to design every year for 3 years. So you know, you have to come up with things. And at the end of that time, you have a portfolio of pieces that you can teach. So they structure it so that you do produce. And if you can't do that, you probably won't stay in the program.
So you're, when you get through that program, you're fully armed then.
Yes.
Yeah.
That's what we like. That's what we try to get people to do, so that you're ready to go out there and start proposing and hopefully teaching.
So do you still teach your first design?
I actually do. I just got a call from a shop. Well, it's been a few months now, but a shop in Denver that wants me to teach my very first piece. And that very first piece is a beginning level piece. And then you don't have a lot of call for teaching beginning level pieces, because you're not going to teach that at a seminar. But, you know, a shop has people that want to learn how to do this. So, yep, I still teach everything I did. All the pieces from NAMM, when I went through NAMM, I still teach.
Huh. That's neat. So that was well worth it for you then.
Definitely.
Yeah. Yeah. Ah. Yeah. Do you, when you design, two questions. When you design, do you design on paper or software first and then stitch? Or do you stitch what comes to your head and then chart it later? And, you know, what, and then what kind, where do you get your inspiration? What inspires you when you do your designs?
Well, I usually start with a sketch, and the inspiration, gosh, that can come from anywhere. I'm in the middle of doing a design that actually was inspired by a pair of earrings that Jennifer Riefenberg gave me for a birthday or Christmas gift. And I saw these earrings and went, yeah, I could do something with this. And, you know, and like we talked, I think we talked before Christine got on the phone, that fire and ice was inspired by a building. So, I mean, inspiration can come from anywhere, but I usually do a sketch first, and I try to make myself do a color rendering next, because that way you can kind of get in your mind where you're going with your piece. If I just start stitching, it usually involves a lot of ripping too. So I try to do a sketch, a color rendering, and a basic schematic of what I want to do where. And then I go to my canvas and start stitching with those, armed with that. And at that point, I start taking notes and graphing things on graph paper as I stitch. I don't go to my computer usually until I'm done. And then it's to write my instructions and make, and, you know, get everything into a program that will work.
Okay, so take us through Fire and Ice. All right, Fire and Ice is one of my favorites of yours, and I saw pictures of it, and then I saw it live. Somebody had stitched it, or actually was most of the way through it, and you got to see the real deal. I don't know how good the pictures can or can't be, but like so many pieces, the real deal is pretty stunning stuff. That is one standout piece. So take us
Thank
through.
You.
I mean, it really is. I'm not feeding you a line. It's really stand out to me anyway. Take us through how that started and the process that you went through to make that happen.
So I was in the Kansas City area. I'm originally from there. And I think it's in Overland Park, Kansas, a suburb of Kansas City. I saw this wonderful building, and it's called the Museum at Prairie Fire, and it's a satellite of the Natural History Museum in New York that they built in Kansas, and they have, you know, traveling exhibits there. So my friend drove me by there, and I went, wait, drive around the block. I've got to have a picture of that. So I took a picture, and what's remarkable about the building is it's all these different panes of glass, and there's all these wonderful angles. And the glass is the is called dichroic glass, and it was developed by NASA. But now we see it in other things, like, you know, you'll get pieces of jewelry made out of dichroic glass. But the glass actually changes color as the light hits it, which is really amazing. And this building is just incredible. You have to look it up. And when I saw this building, I knew I was going to do something. But the building was more like, you know, these irregular sized rectangles were the panes of glass in this piece. And so at first I thought, well, you know, that's really popular in a lot of needlepoint pieces today to do these, you know, like small little squares or rectangles, and then you fill them in with different stitches. And that's where I was heading to begin with. That's what I came home and sketched. And then I sat down and started stitching from that sketch, and I didn't like the way it was going. So I started seeing these, you know, because it's called Prairie Fire, and I started seeing these columns of fire in my mind, and that's the direction I went. Instead of little rectangular shapes, I saw these, you know, like seven columns of fire coming up, and each column would be different. And as I started to stitch it thinking it was just going to be fire. And then the more I was into stitching those fire columns, I just kept thinking about, I don't know, I think there was something on the paper of the Denver paper that said, I think it was about a hockey player. I don't follow hockey, so I don't really know. But they had a big headline that said, you know, whoever they were talking about, fire and ice. And I thought, that's what I need to add to this is the ice. And then I went back and resketched and went forward with it from there. But a lot of the actual development of the individual columns did happen on the canvas. It didn't follow the original color rendering that I did.
That's neat. So you get this all together and get it designed and chart and instructions and all those things. And then you have I assume you have some people who stitch for you to basically proofread the chart?
Well, yes. I always pilot my classes before I teach them, but I usually wait till they've been accepted to be taught, you know, if A&G picks me up to teach for a seminar, then I schedule a pilot class before the seminar. And basically what I do with a pilot class is I treat it just like a regular class. I had come prepared the same way as I would for seminar, and then I teach it, and then there each student in the class is required to stitch a part of it. I mean, hopefully they'll stitch the whole thing, but they need to give me feedback on one particular part.
Oh, so that's how you get feedback fast enough is have people.
Right.
Yeah, okay. All right.
And, you know, we both get something out of it. What I do is I never charge a teaching fee when I do a pilot class. I just charge for the kit. So they're getting it discounted. They're also getting it first. And what I'm getting is the feedback from them on it. You know, they're going to check for spelling mistakes, typos, grammatical corrections. They're going to, if something in class doesn't, you know, if it doesn't go smoothly, we work out, well, what if you taught this first instead of that? Or, you know, what if you did this? And, you know, it's a lot of give and take, and I get all that feedback to make when I go in front of a national seminar that those bugs are worked out.
Okay. All right. I can see that. Yes.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah. So EGA actually requires you to do a pilot class and has some guidelines for you. A&G doesn't require it, but I think most teachers do pilots because it just makes your class run more smoothly, and everyone's going to be happier, the students and the teacher, if you've got all those things worked out before you teach it.
Right. Yeah. And I bet when you do those pilot classes, you have to leave your ego at home.
Oh, yeah, but that doesn't bother me at all. I mean, I feel like it's a team. We're working together to make it work. You know, we're just working out the best ways of, you know, teaching it.
Right. Fun process. All right, I got to get these in because I got to learn about them. Under a copper moon. Now, yes. that is standout stuff, but the first time I saw it, my first question was, how did you do the mountain?
And so that's kind of an interesting story. So I do like to put different kinds of things on my pieces other than just stitching. And so the mountain, I love to go to fabric stores. I've only made one quilt in my whole life, but I still love to go to fabric stores and look at quilt fabric. So I was in a store in Denver that had all this batik fabric, and I saw this gorgeous fabric, and I bought a few yards of it because I just thought it was pretty. I didn't know what I was going to do with it. I just liked it. And then when I was getting ready to do Under a Copper Moon, which I remembered I had that fabric, and so I pulled it out, and it looks like if you see a mountainside where it's been cut for a highway or something, you know, and you see the lines of the earth and how it developed.
Right.
That's what this fabric looks like. And so I thought, well, that's what my mountain needs to be. And so it's done with fabric applique. There's a wool felt underneath the fabric to give it a little bit of padding. So a little bit of dimension, not a lot. I mean, it's thin, but anyway. So that's put on first. And, you know, after you get that on, you have half your piece done. So that's, that makes you feel good.
Well, all right, back up. Okay, tell me how you get that cloth on there, because to me, putting a cloth applique on a needlework canvas, I can just see it look like, you know, easily look like a kindergartner gluing something for the first time, you know, wrinkled and but the picture does not look like that at all. It looks like it's one with the canvas. So how do you pull that off?
Well, it's really slick, and I'm not the only teacher that does this. Jeanette Reese does a lot of fabric applique on her pieces, and other teachers do too, but it's really slick because you use a product called Steam and Seam. It's a fusible web product. And basically it's a very thin fusible web, and you put that on, you know, the back of your fabric, and then you fuse it with heat, an iron, to the surface below. Now, I like to have some padding underneath it so you're not fusing it directly to the canvas, just because I just like the look of that. It makes it a little smoother to have that felting underneath it, and it's not quite as flat, just raises it a teensy little bit. And it's as easy as can be. So.
Because that's the part that I love, the stitching part. But that's the part that impressed me is how you can put fabric on there and have it just look like it's part of the design and not something that somebody tried to glue on. That's pretty slick.
Right. Well, then my panic was, you know, because it got picked up for Anaheim, and then I have a couple of other contracts on it, and I thought, oh, no, I don't know if I'm going to have enough of this fabric to do all these classes. So I thought, and you know how sometimes, I don't know if you know this, but on the selvage of the fabric, sometimes it gives you the manufacturer and the name of the fabric and even a number. So I looked on it. There was nothing like that on this fabric. I called the store where I bought it, and they didn't have any more of it. When I described it, they said, no. So I thought, well, I'm just going to get online and just see what happens, because I might be in big trouble here. And I have put fabric in some of my other pieces before, but it was where the students had a choice of fabric, and you know, like a whole bunch of different autumn fabrics is in a piece I call Autumn Three Ways. And one of the leaves, it's three maple leaves, and one of the leaves is fabric applique, but the students get a choice from a variety of fall fabrics. And you can just find more fall fabrics easily. But this mountain has to be that fabric. So I got on and Googled batik, and the very first fabric that popped up on my screen was that one. So I thought, oh my gosh,
you lucked out.
I must have been doing something right in my life to have that kind of good luck. I don't know what it was, but thank you. So I have a lot of it now.
Yeah, I was going to say, and you bought 14 bolts of it. Yeah.
Well, I bought as much as I could find. Let me put it that way. Because fabric doesn't stick around a long time. They make it. They sell it for that season. Then it's gone. But I bought a lot of it. So I think I have enough now.
Okay, good. Because that was, yeah, that was something I thought of. Okay, I hope she got a lot of fabric because, you know, if that, you know, something like that catches on and, yeah, come teach it here, come teach it there. And yeah, pretty soon, well, I can't anymore because I just don't have the fabric left. So
right.
Yeah.
But that's not the only appliqué on that piece. I don't know if you can tell from the picture, but the moon is actually done on a separate piece of canvas, and it's done with a hot foil technique like they do on greeting cards, you know, when you see foil on greeting cards.
Oh, right.
So on a separate piece of canvas, you apply the copper foil, and then you applique that. You cut out the moon and applique that onto the main canvas.
Oh.
So there's two kinds of appliques. There's the fabric applique, and then the moon is done with the technique of unraveling the canvas and then sinking all the canvas threads through your main canvas to apply the moon so it has a little dimension.
Wow, fascinating. Huh.
I told you I like to... You like to play with needles, and so do I, but I like to play with other things you can put on canvas besides just stitching.
That's pretty neat. Okay, I'll have to watch for this class.
Okay.
All right. Okay, I got one more I got to talk about, and then maybe Christine has one. I don't know, but... the one that, as much as I like Fire and Ice, the one that really appeals to my sense of order and all those weird things I have is
yeah.
that, just shut up. It's Geometric Butterfly.
Oh, that yeah. one. Okay. That one is, it's kind of funny. That was one of my first attempts at designing way before I was a teacher.
Oh.
It goes way back. And I took a class, who was it? Let's see. I took a class on just studying some of the design elements that Frank Lloyd Wright used in his work.
I wondered, yep. Okay.
Yep. And you were just supposed to bring, you know, some threads from home, and she provided a blank canvas. And all we did was just talk about Frank Lloyd Wright and how he used nature in his work, but I studied some of his windows, and they're so mathematical. And I just
yes.
started playing with lines, and that's how that one developed. And I didn't even think it was that good. I was just playing around, but I entered it in at ANG seminar. It was one I didn't even go to. This was before I was teaching. I just entered the piece, and it won a judge's choice. And I was so excited. And then years later, when ANG seminar was in Chicago in 2014, I think.
Yeah, I think that's right. Yeah. I think that's right. Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So when I was proposing for that seminar, I was proposing some other things, and I just thought, oh, I should throw a couple more things in. So I threw that in too, and they picked it up, and people have really liked it. And it's a fun, easy, it's not a hard thing to stitch, but you learn a lot about playing with some of the overdyed threads, and, you know, it's just a fun piece. But that's an old piece, so that was one of the first things I designed.
You know, it's so weird because when I first looked at that, that's one of the first things came to mind was Frank Lloyd Wright. And I thought, nah,
yep.
that has nothing to do with it. Just
No, it does.
that man, I'll tell you what he's done and the impact he's had way beyond his buildings is amazing.
Yeah. Yes.
Ah, okay. Learning things. Great. Okay. Mm-hmm. I'm moving on to something else, Christine, unless you have some of her designs you want to talk about.
No, go right ahead.
Okay, so I wanted we got to time flies with these things. We could be here for hours.
They do.
Yeah. So Tony, I wanted to talk about you do so much because you teach. I mean, you don't sell your designs, right? They're all used for teaching, is that right?
Primarily. I mean, occasionally, like if someone's taken one of my classes and they have another favorite one that they always wanted to do, if I have an extra kit, I'll sell it. But generally, I don't sell except for my teaching.
Yeah. So okay,
I mean,
so,
I might in the future after things, you know, if it's not a teach, if it's not being requested as a teaching piece, then I might sell some of them eventually. But right now, it's just I like to go and teach them.
Yeah. Okay. Well, and you allow ghost stitching, right? Or ghost.
I do, because I try to write my instructions so that, you know, even if you've taken my class, you know how we are. Sometimes we go home and we put things away for a long time.
Yeah.
Right?
Yep. I have a few of those.
So
yeah.
I want to make sure that when you get that back out and you start working on it again, that my instructions will guide you through it. So I do allow ghosts.
Okay. All right. So I'll be looking. All right. So okay. The things I wanted to make sure we explored before we ran out of time is, and the reason I asked about the classes was, I often wonder from someone who teaches as much as you do, what are the biggest mistakes that people make when they go to a class, or things that they don't do that prevent them from really getting the most out of the class? And then what are, you know, the reverse of that then, what are the things you should do, which I guess is really the same question two ways, to maximize the class? What are some of the things you suggest to people or would suggest that would help people get the most out of anyone's class, yours obviously, but anyone's?
Well, the first thing is, it's kind of obvious, but it's still worth repeating, is come prepared. And your teacher should be sending you a student letter that tells you what to bring to class. And believe it or not, sometimes people don't read those. But if you don't get one from your teacher, you should be asking for one. And so that you know that you're bringing all the things you need for class. And then if you come prepared and organized, and then my next thing is gonna sound like, well, that sounds pretty uptight. But then the next thing I'm gonna say is, be relaxed. You're there to have fun. And just listen when the teacher's talking and relax and enjoy yourself. I mean, it sounds simple, but I have people sometimes that are so uptight, you know, that they don't allow themselves to have fun. And this is a hobby for most of us. Not, I mean, it's a job for me, but it started out as a hobby, and we should be remembering that this is a fun thing to do, and you'll get the most out of a class if you go in with the right attitude, really.
And, I mean, your classes, most people at just about any level can take them and
have success? Most of mine are intermediate level pieces. Occasionally might be up one notch from there. But, for example, Fire and Ice, there's no reason that an intermediate, I mean, it's rated intermediate, and you should have success. And, I mean, I feel like that's my job, is to make sure you do and make it understandable. So that, you know, if you have, maybe, you know, you might have a student that never learned something that they needed to know. Well, that's why they're taking a class. That's my job to make sure that they do.
Yeah.
So ask questions if you don't know, and the teacher should be willing to help you with that.
Well, isn't that, and that's a former teacher here, but that's one of the toughest things to get the students to just relax enough that you feel like you can ask a question anytime. I mean, you're paying for this, you're using your time. Ask the questions, get the most out of it, make the most of it.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Don't be that right. One. Don't be that one that's got a question every 3 seconds, but
maybe not, but I do think that, you know, if you don't understand something, the teacher should be able to help you do it. That's why she's there.
Yeah. The reason that's on my mind is the day we're recording this, Christine has Debbie Rowley's, what is it, Diamond Delight 10? Is that right?
Uh-huh.
Yeah, and so she's been, a couple shows ago we were talking about getting threads, and so we were having a texting discussion this morning about threads, and I was listing, you know, obviously the threads that Debbie has listed on the chart and the canvas, and then I started thinking, well, wait a minute, this, you know, she hasn't done one, so then she needs stretcher bars, she needs needles, needs a laying tool. And as I'm listing these things out, I'm thinking, is this the, and of course, Christine can't start at a beginner level. She has to, you know, she can't
right.
help it. But is she can't help it. You know, we're getting her treatment, but it's just not working. But you know, at some point, you know, this I think almost becomes intimidating for some people that, you know, I got to have this and this and this before I can even start. And I, you know, it just started to bother me that, you know, how many people get scared off because, you know, start making a list like that and you go, wait a minute, I just, you know, I just wanted to put some thread in a canvas. And,
well, yeah. And, you know, if you're starting somebody off, you can probably, you know, simplify that list. I think we love our gadgets, but you certainly don't have to have all of them to get started, you know, and you don't want to scare somebody off like that. So we want to encourage people.
Yes.
I think there's easier ways to do it. I mean, you know, we are both the first to admit that, you know, starting out with a piece like this is probably not the best way to build confidence, right? Because it's going to be difficult, and you have to be willing to do something and say, well, that didn't work, and then tear it out. You have to have a high tolerance for frustration. And you also have to have the commitment that, you know what, I think based on other things that I do that I'm going to like this, and I'll do one and I'll probably do more. So, you know, buying the ancillary equipment is not going to really be that much of a hardship to do. But if you're not that person, there's so many things that are already kitted that you could just go into a shop and just get, you know, ready and set that you could do that are small pieces. I don't think it's a simple piece. Just choosing a smaller piece might be a better point of entry.
At the same time, if you're really excited about the piece, that can make all the difference in the world in keeping you motivated.
I agree. That's also an excellent point, right? You have to choose something that you're going to want to work on. That's true.
And of course, if you could find a group of people to stitch with, like a chapter, those people are, you know, going to help you, you know, get going and keep you going. But that sounds like it's a problem right now, but hopefully maybe it won't be.
Hopefully not. And I think that where that helps is when you get stuck, you know, when something that you're reading isn't clear or you don't understand it. And, you know, if you can't turn to the internet and, you know, say, you know, like in knitting, it's really easy. If you want to know how to do, you know, a German twist cast on, you just Google YouTube German twist cast on and there you go. Somebody's showing you how to do it. But with something like this, where you're reading how to do a particular stitch and it's in a piece, sometimes it's nice to have somebody to say, you know, walk you through that actual thing in that context. So yeah, definitely having somebody do that for you, I think, is beneficial. And I think part of it too is learning style. Different people learn different ways.
Right.
Some people learn better having somebody, you know, walk them through like that. And other people learn better sort of bullheadedly doing it and ripping it apart and then doing it until they get it right.
Well, and the other thing you can remember too is I think Debbie is like this. I mean, I've met Debbie. I don't know for sure, but I know I tell my students, you know, if you don't understand something in my instructions, email me, call me.
Yeah, yeah.
Whatever's convenient. I want to help you. So, you know, that's why, I mean, in all my instructions, you have all my contact information. And I think Debbie's probably the same way. So she, you know, go to Debbie.
Yep. She is like that. Yes, very much so. Yeah. Yeah. She doesn't want anybody upset with her charts. She wants them to have success and be proud
right.
of it.
Yeah. Right.
Well, I mean, Christine's going to be the anomaly. She's so bullheaded. It'll get done. Trust me.
Well, you know what? It's not going to be perfect. And I'm also okay with that. And that's part of it too, is that, I'm not going to look at it at the very end and say, this is imperfect and therefore I hate it and I'm never going to do this again. And a lot of people get trapped in that. And I don't have an issue with imperfection.
Good.
You know? Imperfection that is, you know, just careless and lazy, that's a problem. But imperfection because, well, this was the first one and I tried and I could see things that I could have done better, that's, you know, that's a path for growth. That's right. that's not a place for criticism. So I think a lot of it is just your perspective on things. So and when you take that fear away and that need to do things perfectly, it makes things a lot easier.
Yes.
Okay, recommendations. We got ended up. Okay. So, Tony, so okay. Recommendations. What do you have?
Well, first I was going to say the flat iron, but I know several of your, at least one other of your people have already said that. So I thought of some other things. One, this is just a little tip. You know, when you pull cotton floss out of a skein, and whether it's Anchor or DMC, sometimes it really tangles up into a giant knot. Sometimes it just pulls out nice and smoothly. So according to my sources, if you pull from the long end, the label that is the longer label for DMC, if you pull from that end, it will tangle less. You will have a better chance of not ending up with a giant knot. And on Anchor floss, if you pull from the short label end, you will have a better chance of it not knotting up.
Okay, DMC long end,
Anchor
short end.
Yeah. It's the way they wind it that it comes back out correctly. If you unwind it, you know, the way, according to how they've wound it to begin with.
Okay, well, that's a good tip. All right, but now I got to ask you. Do you keep it in the skein, or do you put your floss on bobbins?
I usually keep it in the skein.
Okay.
I don't have time for that. Bobbins.
Oh. I put it on bobbins. I sit down in front of a...
Of course you do.
Yes, you're more organized. More organized. And my other tip is if you're choosing your own color of threads... You know, maybe you don't like the colors on the came in your chart, or you just want to change colors. And you put a bunch of threads out there and you think, okay, I've got this. But then you start feeling like there's something wrong. Most of the time it's because your colors are too close to the same value.
Mm.
And so there's a really neat trick with our modern phones that we all have, our smartphones. Will take black and white pictures. Now, iPhones, which I don't have, will take a black and white photo. I have another brand, and you have to take a color photo and then change it to grayscale. But if you can see your thread colors in grayscale, and they all look like one big mess, you know, one big blob of color, you don't have enough value changes in those colors. And that's a lot of times that's the problem when you're picking colors. It's not that you don't, you know, you like the colors, but they're all the same value. And you can see that by taking a picture with your smartphone and looking at it. And immediately you'll say, oh, those two look exactly the same. So, and they were right next to each other. And that's why I don't like them.
That old photography thing comes back time and time again, because that's, you know.
But
that's
it's, you know, well, the first time I heard it, it was like, put it on a, you know, make a black and white copy on a copying machine, you know. And I thought, well, yeah, right. You have that right by your side all the time. But we have this excellent little, you know, tool now with everybody having smartphones. And it really does. I mean, I know you like photography, and it makes such a difference in picking threads to be able to see that.
But see, that, you know, that's what, when I first started learning photography, that's what I was told, is shoot black and white. Don't shoot color, shoot black and white, because you will learn faster how to control light and those very things, those different values in color, and what makes an image really pop, and what makes it just be flat and just sit there. Same principle, but do it in black and white, because your eye can't compensate with the colors. It has no choice. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Right.
Oh, that's a good one. Yeah. These phones, I'll tell you, every time you turn around, there's a new use for these things. And
I know.
Yeah.
But I do like my flat iron too. But well, I thought I'd try to think of something new.
That's okay. You can mention the flat iron again, because I got to get one of those things. I did not realize how.
It's a great tool.
Yeah.
It is. But I do have to say that. The other day I was listening to one of your podcasts, and someone said, no, you shouldn't use it on flare. It might melt. I have used it on Flare. You just have to go quickly. Just pull that thread through there fast, because it really does improve Flare. But what it does for neon rays is unbelievable.
Hmm. Got to get a flat iron.
And you can get temperature controlled ones too. They're not all just an on off ones. There are some that have where you can control the temperature. So you can just put it on it's like a dial rheostat. You can just lower the temperature and it'll work better.
Yeah. The one I have, they have some mini ones for travel. And those are nice because they fit in your kit, your bag and everything very easily. And mine doesn't have temperature control, and I've never had it burn anything. So, I don't know. And it was cheap. It was like $10. It wasn't a big purchase or anything. So. Yeah.
All right. Got to add that to the kit.
Okay.
The bag of tricks, as they say.
Yes.
Tony, it's been an absolute treat. Thanks for making the time with us here. Really been fun.
Yeah, thank you.
Well, you're welcome, and I can't wait to meet both of you in person someday.
Well, we'll get there. That'll happen. Okay. If nothing else, we'll all come to the mountains.
That's true. We'll have to start traveling.
Yep. All right, that's it. Thank you, Tony, and you've been listening to Fiber Talk, and we'll be back next week. Thanks for listening.